Okay, welcome to episode 3 of the Filmmaker Film Watcher podcast. I'm filmmaker Rich D. Gregorio.
And I'm the film watcher, Greg Rao.
This week we are going to talk about a few films, a few confessionals from last week, which my confessional was I hadn't seen Charade, and Greg's...
Mine was The Bicycle Thief, or Thieves, depending on who you believe, but the famous Italian post-war film.
That's right. And also we're going to review Terry Gilliam's Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
But let's first talk about The Bicycle Thief.
So this is my confession. I had never seen this.
That's right. Look, The Bicycle Thief is about... It's set in post-war Rome, and it's about a man on the first day of a new job. Okay, it's a job that offers hope for his poor and desperate family. Now, on his first day, his bicycle, which he really needs for his work, gets stolen. And with his young son in tow, he sets off to track down the thief. This is an Italian neorealist film. If you're not familiar with that, it's usually known as the golden age of Italian cinema. And it's pretty much this story set amongst the poor and the working class, filmed on location, most of the time using non-professional actors. Italian neorealist films mostly contend with the difficult economic and moral conditions of Italian post-World War II, representing changes in the Italian psyche and conditions of everyday life, including poverty, oppression, injustice, and desperation. And some of the filmmakers that came out of this movement are Roberto Rossellini, Vittorio De Sica, who made The Bicycle Thief, Visconti, you've got Federico Fellini, among a few. So tell me, Greg, what did you think about The Bicycle Thief?
I find this film really hard to judge. And that's because it's not the film itself, it's me in relationship to the film. It's because there's so much in it that puts me outside the film.
Mm.
And I'm really thinking of three things. I'm thinking about that, first of all, it's a world that I don't know. And it's an astonishing insight into that world. We can come back to that. But it's not a world I know. The second thing, of course, is being an Italian film in Italian, and I don't speak Italian. Mm-hmm. You know, ciao, buongiorno, is about it, and bella, perhaps. But it's not a language I know, so I can't actually hear what the people are saying. And the third thing, which really complicated and undermined that for me, is that the DVD which I watched, it was a really bad subtitling experience. Mm-hmm. You know, I can accept that sometimes there is complexity in what's being said in another language in a film, and that not everything will be translated, you know, the nuances in the subtitles. And I know that because I speak French, so
yeah.
I can listen to French and, you know, get the gist of it and know when it varies from the subtitles. I cannot do that in Italian. Mm. So I accept that. But in this particular copy I watched, there were big chunks of conversation that just, there was nothing there.
Yeah, right.
And so I followed, you know, the flow of the story, and I can certainly talk about that, but I really felt like there were things I was missing,
mm-hmm.
and therefore I couldn't quite get it. Having said that, I did feel like from the very beginning I was in a different world, and I got that.
Mm-hmm.
So at the start of the film, you know, the very start of the film, one of the main characters, the father, Antonio, is being called to come and apply for a job that no one else can apply for, which is this guy going around on his bicycle putting up posters for
yeah.
American films and so on. And the landscape he was in, and not knowing about neorealism, I thought at first it was a film set. It was so new and stark and almost otherworldly that I was engaged straight away. Mm-hmm. What is this place? And we go from this place that I'm just guessing. I'm guessing is something that was being built, you know, after Rome had been destroyed by the war. We go back to Antonio's home where he hasn't got a bike, and they've got to get a bike, and you discover that they had a bike which is being pawned, and mm-hmm. they need to redeem it. And the way they do it is that the wife, Maria, takes all the sheets off the bed and they go down to some kind of pawn shop, I guess it is, and they trade the sheets in to get the bike and a bit mm-hmm. of extra money. And then you go in, you know, behind the counter and you see that there are walls and walls of all this, you know, bedding that people are selling just to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm watching, I'm thinking, this is something that intellectually I know must have happened, but I'd never kind of had visualised it before.
Yeah.
And so that, it was an eye-opener. So the very start of it, I was in.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's before I started hitting some of these, well, what are they saying kind of issues yeah. that I had. But then when they go on the journey and you meet the gorgeous boy, Bruno, the son
yes.
who's, what is he, 9 years old,
yeah.
whatever he is.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And after the bicycle is stolen and the father and son go on this, almost this quest on a Sunday to find the bike. my attention was really on the relationship of the father and the son.
Yeah.
Which is at the heart of the film.
Absolutely. I'm a sucker for a father-son story, and this is probably one of the best.
And so am I, actually. Yeah, I know what you mean.
Look, this film, is for me, it strikes such a chord. I mean, look, my family's Italian, so for me it hits home very well because my family left Italy after the war, so they lived in those times,
yes,
as were depicted on screen. So therefore, it is very close to me. And when I watch that, and I just, you know, because, you know, my grandparents, you know, and my family don't ever actually talk about what it was like before they came to Australia because they don't want to talk about it. And they find it very hard to talk about it. Even if I start grilling them, they really don't want to talk about it because it was such hard times that they just think Australia is their new home. And that is it. They don't really want to talk about it. It's too difficult to
go near. And you got me to watch Martin Scorsese's My Voyage to Italy as part of my homework, which I'm still watching. But that seems to be what he was saying about his grandparents as well. They had come from, I think it was Sicily, at least some of them had. And there was all this world he didn't know. Mm. You know, he knew that's where they were from, but he didn't know it.
Yeah.
And he discovered it through film.
Absolutely.
So you're kind of on that same voyage.
Yeah, pretty much. So, you know, when it gets to, say, the end of The Bicycle Thieves and that end sequence when, you know, the father is contemplating stealing a bike.
From the middle of, you know, middle of a sea of bikes, really.
From a sea of bikes. That whole sequence is just beautifully directed.
It's fairly wordless, isn't it?
It is very wordless, yes. Yeah. You're just following, you're seeing his thought.
Mm.
When he decides to steal the bike and gets caught doing so and then has everybody chasing him. And then, you know, the bit which always gets me is when his son sees that and runs up to his father. And
the shock of the son and the shame of the father.
Oh, just is emotionally just gets me every time. The film has such emotional clarity and a brutal honesty, which you don't really get in film these days. I don't think you do because it was filmed at such a time. And same with other films like Open City and whatnot.
But people who weren't actors as well.
Absolutely. No,
there's no artifice.
No. And then there's the shot when they're walking off at the end of that sequence, the boy and the father are walking off, Antonio and Bruno walk off amongst a sea of people. And then it's just like one story in a whole heap of stories of the same sort of nature, of all these so many people who were struggling at that time.
Mm.
It's an amazing movie to me.
There was another thing that kept pulling me out of the story.
Mm.
So let me tell you by analogy. Sometimes I'm watching a film or a TV show and you see characters driving along and they're having a conversation, they make a lot of eye contact, and I sit there thinking, you should be watching the road. You know,
this is
silly. You can't have been driving that long without watching the road. Yeah. Where's your seatbelt? All that kind of stuff. Yeah. And I had a similar kind of reaction to the film about the way the father treated the son.
Right.
So here they are. The boy's only 9 years old. He may or may not have been to these parts of town before, but the father is so focused on getting the bike back that the son is really just following along in his wake. And sometimes the father's just gone off around a couple of corners, just trusting or not caring that the 9-year-old is okay. And, you know, I'm a dad, and I certainly, like you, relate to father-son stories. You know, I'm a sucker for them.
Hmm.
But I kept watching this and thinking, but, you know, what about the boy? You know, what about the safety, the seatbelt part of this? He's just in your wake. And sometimes you go away and he's about to have a wee and then you come back or the boy falls over. At one stage, he's almost hit by a car going past. And I'm just thinking, you know, I know I'm watching it in a different country in the 21st century
with it's different a time values. Thing. I do think it's a time it's difference. Yeah, I know it's
irritating me.
I still think in that time, though, I think, you know, I don't think the father didn't care for his son. I just think there was so much going on. Children were allowed to roam freer back then than now.
There's free and there's, you know, disregarded. The boy actually started to feel to me more like a puppy than a child. And I don't want to read too much into it, but it's interesting that I think his next film
was it like that.
Umberto D, which is all about the dog.
That's right.
And it felt to me like a similar relationship. You know, it's a strong love between the two of them, and yet he was off on his own thing, and the boy was just, it was like a dog, almost. It was
in those scenes
when they're running around the streets. I just found it, I kept coming back to that in my mind, and I would see it again, like almost hit by the car.
I can understand what you're talking about, Umberto D, which is another De Sica film,
which is
another amazing film, but I did not get that connection. No, I disagree with that
one. It would shift. Mm. Like, you know, there were scenes like when he took the son to the restaurant to have the, you know, the nice meal.
Yeah.
And really focused on
his, scene. That's
yeah, focused on his son's
scene.
Pleasure and having a really big treat he would not normally have.
That's right.
And was that just after the father had slapped the son?
I think it might have
been. And then
before
the son had drowned?
So. Yeah,
it was next to that in the story.
Which is an amazing moment. That's quite a powerful moment in the film when he does that.
But see, again, it took me a while to realise what was going on when he thought the son had drowned again because the subtitles just weren't telling me what was going on.
Yeah,
again,
sure.
So, again, I just kept getting pulled out of the story. For no fault of the film.
Yeah.
It's the fault of the subtitles and the fault of... fault's not the right word, but a result of me being in a very different context trying to understand quite what was going on.
Sure.
And for me, maybe it would improve with a second or third viewing and certainly with a different production copy, you know, as I say, better subtitling.
Yeah.
But, you know, I do think it's one of those films that will stick in my mind visually.
Mm. Well, I'll tell you, in terms of a score, what would you give it?
I'm going to give it a 7.
Ooh.
And as I say, I'm rating it on the viewing experience I had, so I'm probably being harsh.
That's
it. But I don't feel that I can give it higher because of what I didn't get out of it.
Look, I think it's a 10. I think it's a masterpiece and one of the greatest Italian films ever made. I think it's an amazing movie. But anyway...
Mm.
That's The Bicycle Thief.
So, Ricardo, your confessional.
Mm-hmm.
So this was Charade.
Yes.
This is a 1963 caper film.
Mm-hmm.
And in it, Reggie Lampert, played by Audrey Hepburn, decides to divorce her husband because their relationship seems to be based on secrets and lies. So after meeting Peter Joshua, which is Cary Grant at his suave best, on the ski slopes... Reggie returns to Paris to discover that her apartment has been stripped bare and her husband Charlie has been murdered. Three strangers, James Coburn, George Kennedy and Ned Glass, all turn up at Charlie's funeral to really make sure that he's dead. And then Reggie is told by a CIA officer, Walter Matthau, that during the war, these three men at the funeral stole a fortune in French resistance gold with Charlie and another man. But Charlie then double-crossed his comrades and took the gold for himself. Shortly after, Peter, which is Cary Grant, reappears to help Reggie to stay alive and solve the mystery of the missing treasure, which everyone seems to think that she has. As the bodies start to mount around her, Reggie doesn't know whether to trust this charming stranger who presents a gallery of shifting identities. Is Peter only after the gold, a murderer, or worse, already married? Charade is directed by Stanley Donen and features Parisian locations and the lush music of Henry Mancini. So, Ricardo, we're moving from Rome to Paris.
Yeah.
What did you think?
I absolutely love Charade. Yeah. I had an absolute ball with it, and I really can't believe I hadn't seen it, really. I'm so glad I have now. It was beautifully made. The screenplay is fantastic. The performances of Cary Grant, everybody really, but Cary Grant and Audrey Hepburn are just brilliant and spot on.
This is the only film they ever made together.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. I should have made more. Their chemistry on screen was just beautiful.
It sparkles.
And their comic timing, the comedy they bring to that screenplay, just from their presence, is amazing. I thought this film was, from the beginning to the end, just such a brilliant film. From the opening title sequence, which I really loved, the animated title sequence.
It reminded me of Vertigo.
Reminded me of Saul Bass, but I thought, was that Saul Bass who did that?
I don't know.
Saul Bass did a lot of the titles around that era. And,
I don't think it was, but I don't know.
It wasn't. It wasn't. I did check. From that onwards, it was just a lot of fun. A lot of fun.
Now, I rewatched this a couple of nights ago, and what really struck me is I remembered loving it as that kind of sparkling comedy caper kind of film, which is how I recommended it to you.
Yeah.
But what really struck me is how this is really a Hitchcock film.
It does remind me of a Hitchcock film.
Oh, no, more than reminded me. And it might pay you at some stage to go back and watch it again once you kind of pass the plot.
Yes. Yeah.
Because, you know, sometimes films come out and they say, oh, it's a Hitchcockian kind of film.
Yeah.
And, you know, whatever. This, to me, is Hitchcock. And it's interesting, it's made in 1963. Hitchcock has just shifted from, you know, the stylish kind of things like North by Northwest, Rear Window, To Catch a Thief, and so on, and Vertigo. And he shifted in 1960 to make Psycho, which we talked about previously. And then in this year, 1963, he makes The Birds. And The Birds actually didn't do as well at the box office as Charade did. Charade apparently was the fifth grossing film of the year. It's, to me, it feels like Stanley Donen stepped in and did Hitchcock of that kind of earlier phase, before he went kind of all black and white gritty. It's like Sandy Donan, who was a musical director. You know, he did Singing in the Rain with Gene Kelly. That's Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. Yeah. He did Funny Face Aboard Your Head.
It's quite an interesting director, absolutely, to do it. I was quite surprised it was.
But then the titles start in a way that reminded me so much of the Vertigo titles.
Yeah.
Different but similar. And then you've got the body thrown from the train, which is, you know, not un-Hitchcock. But then the next thing you've got is the gun coming down from the umbrella on the ski slopes to shoot Audrey Hepburn, which is actually a kid of a water pistol.
Brilliant.
And I don't think I'm original in saying this, but that image is really the expression of the film. This is going to be something dangerous, but don't take it too seriously. It's
absolutely
kind of frivolous.
Absolutely, it's brilliantly done.
And all the way through, and it's actually not got that many sets. There's some outdoor, you know, shots in Paris.
Yeah.
But a lot of it's actually in this little hotel
where
all the bad guys and the good guys are on the same floor in this little out-of-the-way hotel, which is bizarre in its own right.
A young James Coburn.
Yeah, but so all the way through, you've got this kind of comedy thriller, and then there were two bits that really stood out for me.
Yeah.
The first one is that Cary Grant has a fight with George Kennedy, who's got, you know, a hook.
Oh, that sequence.
On the roof of the American Express building
with
the neon light. And you just keep waiting for them to go off the edge. And I couldn't quite work out how they did it without being in danger. Like, it looked real in the background.
It does look real. But, you know, that fight sequence was just a brilliant fight sequence, because nowadays you've got so many sound effects and everything to go with the fight sequence.
Or loud music
or whatnot. This was done pretty silently, and like not a lot of music. The music wasn't that loud in it.
Almost having a conversation, like they know each other.
Yeah, that's right. But it was shot, so like one shot almost. It was interestingly done, but it kept you right there. It was really suspenseful because you didn't know whether they got off the edge or not. It was beautifully made.
And then the second part for me that really struck me this time around was the end. Or near the end. So, you know, I said to you, watch out for the shots of the columns.
Yes, yeah.
So the sort of the big climax is in this place of the colonnade in some, you know, Parisian square.
Mm.
And there's a shot of Audrey Hepburn running and Cary Grant chasing after her. And you feel like you're moving through the columns, but it's actually shifting from him to her to him to her to him to her. And then she's in the middle of the square, and you've got the bad guy and you've got Cary Grant. Try not to spoil the story, but both hiding behind columns. Neither can go out to her, and she's got the treasure.
Yeah.
Neither can go out to her because then they expose themselves to the other.
Yeah.
And then the bad guy engages with Audrey Hepburn, justifying why he's done what he's done. And Cary Grant kind of comes up behind the columns, and the shot is he can't see the bad guy, but he's trying to work his way through the columns.
Yeah.
And I was watching that little bit and I was thinking, this feels like Hitchcock. And it also reminds me of that scene in the Hitchcock film where the bad guy's walking across the stage and there are these numbered trapdoors and the hero pulls the lever and the guy falls through. And then all of a sudden, that's what I'm watching. It's actually in this film.
Yeah.
And I've misremembered it as a Hitchcock film.
Yeah, right.
That whole last bit in particular, you know, the chase and the theatre scene, to me just felt quintessentially Hitchcock. Yeah. And I was really, I didn't remember that. And I was really struck by that this time around.
Yeah. Well, you know, that whole sequence, that end sequence, this whole chase sequence at the very end, when I was watching it, I loved the music in that. It reminded me, like, of The Untouchables, which is a Brian De Palma film. Yep. And Brian De Palma was a big fan of Hitchcock. And so when you watch his films, you know, he does sort of reference Hitchcock quite a bit. But in this instance, I thought, it's you know, he's referenced Charade in some of the music in, say, The Untouchables. This dun-dun, dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun. Dun, 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 which Ennio Morricone did the score for The Untouchables, right? But that music was very similar in Charade, and I'm sitting there going, this is just a brilliant score and very really exciting.
There were some odd things in this for me. the way things keep shifting in the film. So, you know, for example, Cary Grant keeps swapping identities almost at the drop of a hat.
Oh, awesome.
And she kind of goes, oh, you know who I thought you were, but I'll go along with that.
Yeah.
So he's constantly changing, and his persona is changing from good guy to nice bad guy to good guy or whatever. But there are other shifts. So the orange passing scene in the nightclub.
Yes.
I was laughing. I'd forgotten that scene. So Cary Grant's, you know, he's mugging a bit, but he's doing his best to get this orange under his chin in his kind of parlour game from a very stout, dowager kind of woman.
Yeah.
So I was laughing a lot during that. Then he passed it to her,
yeah.
and that's when they kind of first had the body chemistry, yeah, like, because they're in such close, intimate contact. Then she turns around and it's one of these three bad guys, and suddenly it's becoming menacing. And the whole film is this kind of shifts in tone all the way through.
It really does, because there's a scene, it's very comic, you know, and amongst everything that's going on, you get these real comic references, and Cary Grant and Audrey Hepburn, there's lots of comedy in the film. But then when the deaths happen, when deaths start happening...
The deaths are really gruesome.
They're actually really gruesome. And so, you know, you're looking at this film, you're a comedy, the deaths come and you go, oh.
And they get gruesomer.
They do.
So if you don't count the husband at the start of the film, you know, being thrown from the train, then the next one is someone submerged in a bathtub. That's relatively peaceful.
That's right.
Next one is someone who's had their throat cut in an elevator, and you hear the screams, you know, off camera, if you like, and then you see blood all over his pyjamas, whatever it is. And then the last one, you know, he's got a plastic bag over his head.
That's right.
He's tied and handcuffed to a desk in a heater, and in his dying frenzy, he's written the name of, you know, who killed him on the carpet, he must have kind of, I'd say it's very neat,
yes,
but, you know, it must have kind of scrawled in as he died.
Yeah.
And yet, not so much the last one, but the first two, all of a sudden there's this comedy bit because they've been moved into their bed and they're supposed to have died in their pyjamas, you know, drowned in bed, had their throat cut in bed. It's all quite weird.
That's right.
And meanwhile, again, Cary Grant's going through these really quite profound shifts because she's in love with him. I mean, she's in love with him pretty much all the way through.
That's right.
But she's in love with him, and then she finds out that actually she can't trust him. And then the things he says, which are meant to be nice, like, don't worry, I'll just be next door, actually become quite menacing. And then he shifts again, and she's, you know, trusting and loving him, and then it shifts again. It's just so skillfully done in writing, directing, acting, and so on.
It is. And then you got this scene, which was, to me, I was in hysteria. I was laughing a lot in this scene. I just thought it was brilliant. It was when Cary Grant, if you've seen the film, you'd know what I mean, but Cary Grant takes a shower in his drip-dry suit. And it to me, is just one of the funniest scenes of the film.
But do you know why he did that?
Why did he do that?
Well, Cary Grant was very funny about being in a film with Audrey Hepburn. Audrey Hepburn had been in a lot of films where she was, you know, the virginal ingenue to an older man. So you had Humphrey Bogart in Sabrina, you had Fred Astaire in, I think it's Funny Face, I think there's another one with somebody else. And Cary Grant just didn't think people would believe and felt uncomfortable playing a scene where he was so much older than her. So he was, I think, 58, 59, she was 33, 34.
Yeah.
He'd had opportunities to play opposite her and he'd turned them down for different reasons. And then he accepted this film. And the reason he accepted it was because they went away and rewrote the script. So that a lot of the, you know, the, if you like, the sexual aggressor lines are given to her rather than to him.
Well, they make reference of that.
Yeah.
They're on a boat on the ferry in Paris. And then she makes reference of his age.
Yeah, or the glasses. Oh, you don't need those. Oh, yes, you do.
Yeah,
yeah, there's lots of little jokes.
That was partly
his comfort. And the reason he did the shower scene in his suit was he just didn't really want to show his 60-year-old body or near 60-year-old body on camera having the shower, so he did it in the suit.
It works so well. It's brilliantly done.
Now, I can't leave this film without saying two other things. The first one is Walter Matthau.
Brilliant.
Because Walter Matthau, in my mind, is always a comedy actor. Now, this is just before he really hit the big time where he won the Oscar for Fortune Cookie.
Mm-hmm.
So he was on his way up. He'd been around for quite a while, I think, but just hadn't quite hit that zenith where he really, in particular, became known for comedies. And although the part he plays here is very dry, so there is some comedy to it, he's very straight and, you know, there's other things around him we probably can't say.
Yeah.
That made it, for me, a really great performance from him.
Yeah, he was. He was very good.
And not to downsell, you know, James Coburn, Ned Glass and George Kennedy.
But I thought everybody was great in it. I thought it was a pretty flawless...
The French Inspector.
Yeah, brilliant. I thought it was a flawless production. I think the screenplay is amazing. I think the directing... And this is one thing about when you were watching all these older films is that you notice the camera work in them and everything's done for a reason. Every little movement of the camera is done for a reason. If they don't need to move it, they will not move it, and they'll keep it on the performances. And it's something which rarely happens these days in the era of say digital now, which everybody just shoots a lot of coverage in order to just cut as much as they can. And there's such a patience in this filmmaking, which is really refreshing to watch. And you sort of wish that films were like that now.
There is one jarring note for me in this, and that is the boy. The boy just wasn't quite right. I think I'm right in saying that, in fact, he was dubbed by a French actress, and I think it shows his voice doesn't quite feel like it belongs to him. And you compare his performance with Bruno in the Bicycle Thieves.
That's right.
Yeah, that boy is fantastic.
Yeah.
And walks all over a lot of child actors, you know, of Hollywood and so on. Yeah, it just feels real. The boy just didn't quite fit in for me. Important in the story, there was just a false note there somewhere that just kind of just jars a bit for me.
Mm-hmm.
But taking everything you were just saying about, you know, how this is just perfectly done and so on, the second thing that we have to mention is the remake. Now, which, I know you haven't seen this.
I haven't seen The Truth About Charlie, no.
So The Truth About Charlie was made in, I think it was about 2002, so about 40 years later. I have to say I haven't watched it. I've kind of skimmed it because I heard it wasn't very good. And I have to say the parts that I've watched, it really, it dies. You know, you've got this wonderful sparkling gem and then you've got this kind of clunky rock copy that tries to modernise it and just, you know, doesn't work. It's a sad thing.
Look, I don't know why you would remake it.
No.
I really don't. I think, and you know, Mark Wahlberg, he's a great actor, Fenton Newton, they're great, but why would you even come, they just don't come close. You can't come close to matching the chemistry of Cary Grant or Audrey Hepburn. They are just, they're perfect.
Well, you can also locate this historically. So, you know, in an earlier podcast, I talked about how Love Actually had come out in the shadow of 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
Charade was released literally 2 or 3 weeks after the Kennedy assassination. So it was very much a product of, you know, that Camelot period, you know, a bright, shining period that really was probably the tail end of the 50s rather than the start of the 60s. In fact, there's a line where they both talk about, you know, we might be assassinated. Mm. And that line for the initial release was dubbed over with something else because it seems to be too sensitive. And then it got restored. So it's just interesting that to put it in its historical location, it really was at that kind of really, you know, sparkly, shiny America kind of thing. And America engaging with the world post-war, which is what they're doing. They're filming in Paris.
That's right, yeah.
So, Ricardo, the score.
I think it's a classic. I think it's a 10.
A 10 for you?
Yeah.
I'm giving it a 9.
I was going to give it a 9, but then when I thought about it, I thought, I cannot fault it. I think this is, from start to finish, a very, very perfectly made film. And so I thought, why wouldn't I give it a 10?
Well, the reason I give it a 9 is that for me, a 9 is something which is absolutely at the top of a genre.
Mm-hmm.
And a 10 is something that just overreaches a bit and does something stronger, more profound. And you and I have talked about this. I'm not even quite sure what a 10 film actually is. I'm going to have to discover this across these podcasts. But look, it is absolutely right up there for me. And so it's certainly a 9. And maybe I'm being a bit begrudging. I'm just keeping that space maybe for something else. But look, if it's not a 9, it would be a 10. But for me, I'm going to go 9.
Sure. So the film we are revisiting this week is Brazil. Minor bureaucrat Sam Lowry, Jonathan Pryce, seems happy with his job in the corner of the Ministry of Information, a dysfunctional bureaucracy in a world that looks suspiciously like the 1940s, but with a quaint mix of technologies and a never-ending supply of duct pipes. But at night, Sam dreams of flying through Hollywood cloudscapes and rescuing his imaginary lover, Kim Greist. When a real bug in the ministry system destroys an innocent man, Sam is lured out of his cozy corner to literally pass the buck and then go in search of his dream woman, who proves to be real, even if Jill's hairstyle, clothing and occupation are more trucky than Veronica Lake. Along the way, we meet a range of characters within a self-obsessed and uncaring society. Perhaps most noteworthy are Robert De Niro, who is obviously enjoying his part as the rebel heat engineer, Tuttle, with a touch of SAS in his blood, and Michael Palin, as a pleasantly benign family man who turns out to be the ministry's torturer or information retrieval officer. Terry Gilliam and playwright Tom Stoppard co-wrote this 1985 film with Charles McCowan, who plays a minor bureaucrat called Harvey Lime, perhaps as a reference to his role as the third man in the writing team.
So, and let's unpack that joke a bit. You know, Harry Lime is the character in The Third Man. Here, he's the guy in the office next door to our hero, Sam, who keeps pulling the desk through the wall to get more space.
Right, yeah. Okay.
Which is a nice little touch.
That is, yeah, that's great. That was Orson Welles, The Third Man.
Yes. So, for me, watching this again, I saw it when it first came out 30 years ago at the cinema, and watching it again, I remembered the film better than I watched it this last time around.
Yeah, right.
But before I get on to that, the thing that struck me is that, well, two things. From the very start, how prescient it was.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, I think it's a very English film, made by an American director who spent a lot of time in English culture, part of Monty Python and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly it felt very Pythonesque at times all the way through it.
Yeah.
What really struck me from the very beginning was this is a society where things are controlled mm-hmm. by the threat of terrorism.
That's right.
And that's where we find ourselves now.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe, you know, 1985, that's towards the end of the IRA bombings in London. So they were probably living through an experience that had never touched us before.
Mm-hmm.
But I watched the start of the film and thought, wow, this is us now.
Well, even they've got the slogan in there, which is suspicion breeds confidence. and I think it's perfect because I think this is exactly what's going on today. I think terrorism is used to keep society fearful so they can be controlled.
And that's exactly what's going on in the film.
It's exactly what's going on in the film. So I think that theme is completely of the present day. And even the small things, even the technology in there, there's screens everywhere. You know, there's flat screens.
But it's the old and the new kind of, for that time, thrown in together.
Absolutely. Mm. And it's quite amazing because this film came out in 85, but it would have been shot in 84, which is quite...
1984, George Orwell,
that's
yes.
That's right. So it's quite interesting.
Oh, look, there are fingerprints all over this of George Orwell and Monty Python.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that I was tuning into is that there are other kind of, you know, very British things in it. And I'm thinking of two things in particular. So the first one was at the very start when the head of the ministry is being interviewed by someone on the TV, and he talks about the terrorists almost as though it's the opposing sporting team.
That's right.
And the interviewer says something like, you know, well, but it's been going for, I think it's 11 years, and he says, oh, it's beginner's luck. It's like this is kind of almost gentleman's sporting match.
Yeah, that's right.
And I was really struck, once Sam goes to this other job and joins the heart of the Ministry of Information...
Mm.
There's a scene where Ian Richardson, who people might know as the Prime Minister from the original House of Cards, and a well-known Shakespearean actor, is striding through the corridors in one of these grey suits that they're all wearing and being followed along by, you know, a retinue of men in these same things, waving pieces of paper at him. I found myself thinking of Alice in Wonderland. It was you know, the Red Queen or even, you know, the race around the pool. You know, these sort of self-obsessed characters who are doing something entirely pointless and everyone's kind of, you know, part of that. And then you've got Alice or Sam kind of on the edge looking and going, this kind of doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
So very, very British stuff all the way through it. And as I say, it's an American director, but of course written by Tom Stoppard, who I think actually originally is Czechoslovakian, and then Charles McCown, who I think is a British actor. So, this film could not have been made anywhere else.
And the fantasy sequences were fantastic as well. I mean, they're a major part of the film.
That's really what I remembered from last time, was flying through those clouds with the wings.
Yeah, and, you know, and as you know, it starts off with this amazing sort of dreamscape of him flying through the clouds, and he sees his perfect woman. It's all beautiful along these beautiful hillsides. And whatnot, and as you gradually go through, his world starts becoming more oppressed. Therefore, his dreams start becoming more nightmarish, and so you're getting, you know, start sort of blending into his real world.
Yeah, but you know, his real world is a funny place. I don't think I was as aware 30 years ago as, you know, last week rewatching it, how no one actually cares about anyone. So he thinks it's not a good idea that the wrong man, you know, the innocent man was destroyed by the system. So his care is really about fixing an administrative error and not getting stuck with this check and getting blamed for the mistake.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, the children who destroy each other playing games with, you know, the kerosene or whatever it was at one point stands out. The one stage, a moment that really rang true for me, he's driving out, I think it's when he's driving out to return the check to the widow, and he gets in the little car
thing,
he's listening to the radio, and there's a broadcast about, you know, this building was blown up and, you know, a dozen or more people were killed, and he kind of goes and switches across to the Muzak, the Brazil song. And, you know, I do it. You know, there's this horrible stuff and you think, oh, I can't take the scene in your flick.
But even, I mean, they take it further as well. When you look at, there's lots of terrorist attacks which happen, say, in a department store, and people just keep moving on.
They're not in the restaurant. This is a world of appearances. The glad wrap kind of, you know, cosmetic surgery.
Oh, the cosmetic surgery when he's the stretching of the face.
Or the woman whose acid burn is getting worse and worse. But it's just a complication.
Yeah, that's right. It was a complication of a complication.
But, you know, it is a world of appearances. And I said to you, watch out for a moment in the film, and that was the restaurant scene and the mother's hat. The mother's hat is, you know, an upside-down boot. And I remember the first time I saw it, thinking about the one of the famous quotes from 1984, the George Orwell book, where he says, if you want a vision of the future, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever. And this hat, to me, the inverted boot. That this thing, which in Orwell's film was something which was, you know, something horrible and stamping your face forever, yeah. And you know, and the pain and the degradation never stops, is now turned upside down, has a leopard print or something on it, and it's this fancy hat that she's wearing. To me, that was like a symbol that had been put in there as that kind of reference in a very nice, subtle kind of way.
Yeah.
But that's one of the things I very much remember from it, you know, those 30 years ago.
Bob Hoskins and Robert De Niro get top billing in this film.
Do they? Okay.
All right. And it's quite interesting because they've both got they've got minor roles in this, the film itself. What did you think about their involvement?
I didn't think Hoskins' role or performance were particularly anything, you know, it was an important part of the story, an officious guy with a nasty edge to him.
Yeah,
so
that was...
He was fine. As was Jim Broadbent as a cosmetic surgeon, you know, it was meant to be a garish kind of
But didn't get top billing, part. Though. Didn't get top billing, though.
No, but De Niro was good. And De Niro, I imagine, is top billing because, you know, he was a very well-known, American actor. So it draws the funding, it draws the audience and so on.
Oh, it does.
But he's loving his part.
Oh, he's loving it. You can just see it. Oh, yeah, he's very good.
And because American actors don't necessarily go well in British films, but he just works.
And the violence in this is quite inventive as well. The scene where Bob Hoskins and they dive through the sewage pipe going into their...
That's a polite way of saying it. Into their suits and they drown or explode in a pile of poo. I think Jonathan Pryce is very, very good in this part.
He is.
I think Kim Grease, I think you say, is very good in her part. And I'm surprised she never really did anything else because I remember at the time thinking she was gorgeous as the fantasy figure.
Yeah.
And she was like someone I would like to meet as a kind of a grounded, you know, the real person.
Yeah.
And I've checked, I don't know that she really did anything afterwards. I don't know why not. Mm. And I think that's a bit of a loss.
Mm.
But I also think we really have to talk about Michael Palin.
Yeah, that was a very interesting role. A great role. I mean, really, it's quite a hard role to play.
I mean, Michael Palin is known as Mr. Nice Guy.
Yeah.
You know, always has been.
Mm. But I think that's why he was cast.
Oh, absolutely. And his character on the surface is a very nice, as you said, you know, benign kind of guy. He's obviously ambitious because he changes his wife's name so it's actually the name that the chairman thinks it is, rather than her having her own identity.
Oh, but that scene
he's
in his office when he's got this bloody coat and he's, you know,
handprints
all over it. And
his daughter's playing in the corner. And the other bit I really loved around there is the secretary in the torture area, who's got those kind of electrode-y things attached to her finger to take dictation of the testimony from the torture room, which just consists of people screaming.
Yeah, that's
and you see that a couple of times.
You do.
And that for me is very Monty Python, actually.
Yeah, yeah. The film is quite a mad film.
It's a madhouse. It's Alice in Wonderland.
It's very hard to write that sort of film. It's very hard to get the structures right in a film like that.
Well, and for me, it doesn't quite. So what really struck me this time as well was, having seen other Terry Gilliam films since, and I hadn't when I first saw it, that I was really aware of what I see the strengths and the weaknesses of Terry Gilliam as a filmmaker. So all the things we've talked about and we haven't talked about, like, you know, the visual sensibility is just brilliant. You know, you talk about the fantasy scenes. And some of those scenes are a little bit dated because the technology's moved on, like the buildings thrusting out of the ground.
But I thought they looked amazing, though.
Oh, to me, they looked a bit like a model, but
in
their time, I have no problem with that. You know, just things have moved on, and maybe we are a bit more sophisticated in our expectations. That's a quibble. I mean, the visual sensibility,
but even
fault is there. You know?
Yeah, but even in the present day scenarios of it, I think the art direction of the film is fantastic. That to me does stand out, and there is a lot of great filmic elements to those, just as much as the fantasy sequences.
Look, I agree, but I have problems. My problems are the problem I have with Terry Gilliam in general is that to me he comes across as being too undisciplined as a filmmaker.
Mm.
So there are two sequences, and it's a very long film. It's somewhere between 2 and 3 hours, isn't it? It's quite long.
Oh, it's 2 hours and 15 minutes.
That's right. Yeah. The chase with the truck, you know, when he first really meets Jill, that goes on and on and on. And it's good to have that moment in that sequence where he's going, oh, we beat the bad guys and we crashed the barrier. Yeah. And he looks back and he realises he's caused the flaming death of a soldier. And
yes.
I think that's the turning point for him in terms of empathy and compassion.
Mm-hmm.
So that moment's needed, but it just goes on too long. And then the other one is the big sort of dream sequence at the end. or I'm not sure you call it a dream, but the, well, the fantasizing.
Yeah, the
to
fantasizing.
To me, it just went on and on and on, and there were some good bits in it, like, you know, the Robert De Niro disappearing in a pile of
in
paper.
A pile of paper. It's just
to me, it felt almost like The Red Shoes. Have you seen that?
Yes,
that actually, film? Yeah. It felt very like that. But the extended gunfight getting out of the building and then going into the funeral, it kind of worked, and certainly seeing, you know, his mother in the form of his fantasy love, you know,
yes,
Jill,
yeah,
worked. But again, it just went on and on too much. The, yeah, the ending was right for the film.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think the ideas are all fantastic in there, but I did find it does drag.
You almost need someone to sort of come over the top and say, like, I'd be curious to know, is he the editor or not?
But they are great scenes. They are fantastic scenes on their own, so I can understand them finding it very hard to sort of to take out. But I
not really. For me, I was sitting there going, "Oh, really? Come on!" Those two bits, I really just thought it needed more, almost a hard heart to cut it back.
Look, I don't think it's a perfect film, but I still think it's telling the future in a lot of ways, and because of its present day themes in it, in terms of a score, I give it an 8.
Yeah, for me it's a 7. When we first talked about choosing this film, I thought I'd be somewhere on an 8 or maybe even slightly higher.
Mm.
But when I sat down to look at it, it dropped for me, not because it had dated, but because I was that much more aware of these bits that I just thought something really should have been, somebody sort of stepped in. And so for me it's a 7. It's a very good film, but I think its excellence is kind of nibbled away at because of those little bits in there.
I just look at it from a pure perspective of this is a film like that. I just haven't seen a film like it right now in this present time. And in terms of the writing of it, the screenplay, it's very hard to structure a film like Brazil. And in terms of just the screenplay aspect of it.
So how do you feel it stacks up against his other films?
I think it's his best.
I'd probably say this and or 12 Monkeys.
So that concludes episode 3 of the Filmmaker Film Watcher podcast. Next time we'll be reviewing a Kubrick classic, Dr. Strangelove.
Or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb.
That's right. We always have a confession. My confession is...
The Sound of Music. I cannot believe...
I don't know anybody
who has never seen The Sound of Music. And I'm tempted to make you go to a sing-along one, but let's start small.
No. Yeah, so that's The Sound of Music.
From 1965. I think this is the 50th anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
And my confession is that much as I love musicals, I've never actually seen Cabaret.
Now, I can't believe you haven't seen that. Cabaret is a musical which I love, and it's one of, you know, it's I can't wait to talk about
it. And
it's
just struck me, these are both musicals with Nazis.
True.
We'll see what we think next time.